This is Making Sense of the Media. I'm Craig Kopp. Even though it is a huge part of a lot of people's lives these days, Facebook just turned 10 years old this week. And if you've been on Facebook this week, this music is probably familiar to you. That's the soundtrack to your Facebook movie. In honor of its 10th birthday, Facebook came up with a program that generates a video from the things you've written and the photos you've posted since you joined the social networking site. To Facebook users, this is either the greatest thing since sliced bread or evidence that Facebook has jumped the shark and is on its way out. Here to talk about the phenomenon of the Facebook video is Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute's Sense-Making Project. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Craig.
Kelly, how did they do this? Because you got to admit, at first blush, this video is kind of cool.
So Facebook did what Facebook does best, which is they wrote an algorithm. And this algorithm goes through your posts and it picks out what it thinks are the most significant moments. I've looked at hundreds of these videos, and the algorithm definitely gives preferences to babies and puppies and smiling groups of people. It only selects from things that you've posted, but it's not clear how it knows what the most significant moments in your life are. Some people this works really well, and some people it doesn't work at all.
A picture of one of my cats made it, but that seems to be a bit of a rarity. They seem to prefer dogs over cats.
Yeah, I definitely think there's a bias against cats. I have lots of cat photos on my Facebook page, but only my dog made my movie.
Oh, you did generate a Facebook movie. What'd you think of yours in general?
You know, at first I loved it. I thought it was very charming. I did it in the first hours that it was available. But since then, I cannot stand to hear that music anymore. I was almost going to scream when you were playing it. They get pretty annoying pretty quickly. Once you see them all together, you realize that it's not unique to you, that Facebook doesn't really know what your most significant moments are. It's guessing, and it's essentially turning your life into a cliche so that it looks like everybody else's life.
Isn't that what Facebook is all about to a certain extent already?
Well, I think that if that's what it becomes about, it certainly will be the demise of Facebook. And this is why some people are really annoyed. Sometimes significant others were not included. There were glaring errors, you know, like your spouse or one of your three children didn't make the movie at all. That creates some hurt feelings. And then in other cases, you saw these hilarious inclusions. One guy in Orlando had a decapitated squirrel as his final scene setter. It's funny no matter what, but it doesn't necessarily capture the uniqueness of your life.
I think there's something a little bit creepy about allowing Facebook to try to decide what's important in my life.
You know, actually, that's where I am most reassured. Really, my conclusion is Facebook doesn't know what your most significant moments are. It can guess, and it can make a pretty educated guess, but it's not going to nail it every time.
Do you think this is the end of Facebook as we know it, this little movie they generated for their 10th anniversary?
Hardly, but I do think that it's the beginning of some pretty hysterical memes.
Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute's Sense-Making Project shot in your Facebook movie you'd like to never see again.
I'm going to do yours instead, Craig. It's that photo of you on the beach without a shirt.
This is Making Sense of the Media. I'm Craig Kopp. Nerd alert! The Copy Editors National Convention was shaken to its core recently when a change to the Associated Press style book was announced.
The editors really dropped a bombshell when they announced that over is now interchangeable with more than when referring to numbers. Those attending the conference didn't take the news well. A reporter from the Poynter Institute noted the announcement elicited a gasp from the assembled copy editors.
The Twitterverse exploded too, and the debate still rages over this little change to what's acceptable language. Is it the stuff of very picky people, or do words really matter this much? Here to talk about that is Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute's Sense-Making Project. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Craig.
So, Kelly, is this much ado about nothing, or is this nerds picking at things, or is this really important?
Well, if you listen to the copy editors, this is a significant change. In the past, those of us who had to pass the AP style test to get out of copy editing 101 in J school, this rule was drilled into us. You use the word over when you're talking about the physical relationship of something. I am standing over you. And you use more than when you're talking about numbers. It costs more than $10. There are many of us who never got this rule right, especially when it came to numbers, and feel like you can communicate what you mean without the pickiness over these very small words. However, copy editors make the point that precision is very important in language, and that when you lose precision, you actually lose your ability to communicate.
Kelly, despite the fact that newspapers are having a hard time, magazines are having a hard time, on the internet, there are actually more words being printed than ever before, or at least read. I would think that precision is probably more important now than it used to be.
You know, I like to use the metaphor of wine. When I was a kid, we had very few options if you wanted to buy wine. There were maybe 20 or 30 varieties in the supermarket. And now you go into the supermarket and you have an entire aisle, both sides, filled with wine. A lot of that wine is pretty mediocre. It's all around 20 bucks a bottle. It doesn't cost that much. And it's palatable, but it's not great. I think that our news diet is very similar. Most of the stuff that we see is fairly mediocre. It was created quickly. It doesn't have a lot of resonance. And we really only get to the truly great stuff every once in a while. That's just because there's so much out there that you really have to work to find a finely crafted editorial or essay or even a straight news article.
So are you saying we have a choice here as news consumers to pick up the two-buck Chuck blog or to go for a finer vintage piece of work? We need to look for it.
I'm saying that as a democracy, we're actually in a better place when we have more information available to us. But as consumers of literature, we're going to have to work a little harder to find the really good stuff.
Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute's Sensemaking Project, were you surprised at the furor over this change in the AP style book?
Yeah, because I'm one of those people who could never remember which one to use.
This is Making Sense of the Media. I'm Craig Kopp. Bill Cosby is one of the most beloved entertainers in America. He's Dr. Huxtable, for crying out loud. But now allegations of sexual assault, decades-old allegations of sexual assault, have resurfaced to haunt Bill Cosby in a big way. And it all started with a viral video of comedian Hannibal Buress making jokes about Cosby's dark past, which Newsy reporter Christian Bryant says might change the Cosby storyline forever.
The image of Cosby as the all-American TV dad who happens to be black is memorable, and the only image a lot of people would probably like to remember. But at least one Flavor Wire writer thinks Cosby's allegations will be harder to forget this time, saying one stand-up clip in the internet era can go far, as this story proves. A story like this no longer withers as it once did.
Why are the allegations against Bill Cosby sticking now when they didn't 10 years ago? Here to talk about that's Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute's Sensemaking Project. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Craig.
Kelly, is the difference between 10 years ago and now for Bill Cosby as simple as the existence of social media?
Yes, and the critical mass that's on social media. For me, this story is the internet story of the year because it snuck up on us. Nobody predicted that this story was going to blow up this year, and it really blew up because of two particular things. You mentioned the comedian, but Cosby's camp responded to the comedian with a meme generator that backfired on them. They asked people to create memes of Cosby with their favorite quotes, and instead people created some really vicious memes accusing him of being a rapist.
That's fascinating. So part of this internet story about Bill Cosby and social media is that the Cosby camp did it to themselves?
Well, they certainly exacerbated the problem. Absolutely.
And I guess that shows they did not have a clue about how this might work out on the internet.
You know, the Cosby camp was accustomed to the old media relationships that they had built. David Carr of the New York Times did a really great piece examining all of the journalists who had written about Cosby and not brought up the rape allegations, even though they were very well documented. And he suggested that journalists were complicit in letting Cosby have a pass on that sort of scrutiny. And he was right. The Cosby camp was counting on the old media backing them up. And instead, the old media saw the social media interest in this story and started digging in.
So this whole social media explosion on the Cosby story is really kind of a tacit indictment of the way the traditional media once handled the story?
Absolutely. You know, the allegations first came out in 2004 in Philadelphia with a Temple University employee. And in 2005, there was a lawsuit. In 2006, Philadelphia Magazine did a very well-documented story called Dr. Huxtable and Mr. Hyde. And then there was nothing until in 2014, this year, Newsweek did an interview with one of his accusers, and then the comedian did his thing, and that started the ball rolling.
Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute's Sense-Making Project, will this be Bill Cosby's epitaph now?
I'm pretty sure it will be mentioned in the first three paragraphs of his obituary.
This is Making Sense of the Media. I'm Craig Kopp. The Interview is a comedy from stoner bros Seth Rogen and James Franco about a TV entertainment reporter and his producer who get an interview with the leader of North Korea and then try to assassinate Kim Jong-un at the request of the CIA. This is not highbrow stuff. As you would see in the movie, if you could see the movie. Sony Pictures has decided not to release the film after terrorist threats against movie theaters.
Here's the statement from Sony in part. We are deeply saddened at this brazen effort to suppress the distribution of a movie. We stand by our filmmakers.
But does Sony stand by its filmmakers if it's decided not to release their film? Here to answer that question and a lot more is Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute's Sense-Making Project. Hi, Kelly.
Hey, Craig.
Kelly, this story started way before the threats against movie theaters. This terrorist group hacked Sony Pictures' computer systems and divulged a whole lot of embarrassing information. The media was all over those leaks. Should the media have been all over those leaks?
You know, this has been the question that has preoccupied me for 2 weeks now. The emails were clearly stolen by bad people with bad intentions. And yet, there's some information in these emails that is in the public interest. And so journalists everywhere are asking themselves, is it okay to mine this information? And what I've been telling them is, you have to make sure that you have a very high journalistic purpose, that you have to be acting in the public interest. A lot of the information in those emails, merely curious, funny, embarrassing, not in the public interest. But there have been some stories that I think have shown the American public behind the scenes at Sony and behind the scenes at other large American corporations, including the New York Times.
That would take a lot of discernment, it seems to me, on the part of a reporter to decide what's in the public interest and what isn't.
It's a moving target, and it really depends on the newsroom that you work for. For instance, Deadspin linked to a couple of emails by Channing Tatum and George Clooney. Those were just funny, not really in the public's interest. BuzzFeed did a story on how Maureen Dowd was apparently allowing people at Sony to review her column ahead of time. Maureen Dowd denies that. That's a little more in the public interest because Maureen Dowd is a powerful columnist. The New York Times is perhaps one of the most influential media outlets. Bloomberg did a really, really good story on how Sony apparently has access to the medical records of thousands of its employees. That's clearly in the public interest because what our corporations do with our medical records, we all want to know the answer to that question.
Just to be clear, Kelly, some people think Edward Snowden is a bad guy. So what's the difference between reporting his leaks and reporting these Sony leaks?
Edward Snowden believes that the information that he revealed was important for the American citizens to self-govern themselves. There's no pretense here that the people who hacked into Sony believe anything other than that they wanted to harm Sony.
Kelly McBride of the Poynter Institute's Sense-Making Project, we have really entered the world of cyber warfare here now. Did this alleged North Korean cyber terror group win the first battle by having journalists do these reports of the Sony leaks and by Sony pulling the interview from release?
You know, Craig, the fact that you and I cannot go see Seth Rogen and James Franco make fun of North Korea is a win for North Korea.